His position of presumed authority affects not only me, but the victims' families, the press, and the entire public. The email said it all. He was irked by what he saw as a personal attack on his investigation, integrity, and competency. At the June meeting, Rossmo gave his presentation. While his backup material came from newspapers, magazines, and television, not trial transcripts or personal interviews, he did quote ADA Robert Smith as saying, "There never was a fifth man." After a short discussion, the commission voted. Wanting more time to study the resolution, the chairman abstained, but everybody else was in favor, and it was passed to the city council. Barbara Ayers Wilson called Rossmo's idea a slap in the face, and Bob Ayers phoned him to ask a few questions. Some months later, the council rejected the proposal. Rossmo remains hopeful. He thinks there's about a 15% chance the guys who got arrested are guilty. The storage room. Pictures often make things look bigger than they are. To understand the true dimensions of the back room of the ICBY shop, you have to go there, which I did in 2012, the year after a Vietnamese family renovated the shuttered shop and turned it into a nail salon called Classy Nails and Spa. The front part looks completely different now. No more Mexican tile or wood-paneled walls, and the counter where frozen yogurt toppings were once displayed has been removed. Just inside the front door, a recycling waterfall makes a splashing sound as water travels up one side of a tall sheet of bubbled plexiglass and down the other. Beyond it are 10 mani-pedi chairs and several nail stations. The walls have been painted a soft mint green and are decorated with photos of idyllic beach scenes, and between them, flat-screen TVs tuned to either C-SPAN or a muted sports channel. There are orchids and soft background music. Toward the rear, the women's bathroom, now unisex, is the same as it was in 1991, but the men's room has become a place where employees either take breaks or do laundry. Across from it, where the sink was attached to the wall leading to the walk-in cooler, are two small massage rooms, one for individuals, the other for couples. The storage room itself, however, is eerily the same, dark, dank, the concrete floor painted gray, and along the south wall, steel storage shelves. When firefighters and police officers speak of Amy's being alone and speculate that perhaps the other three girls had already been killed and she was running away, they seem to indicate a flight from one room into another. In fact, there was no other room. Amy's body lay only 4 feet from Sarah's. When I asked one of the classy manicurists if she knew what the shop had been before they moved in, she replied quickly, "Cash in advance." "And before that?" "Yogurt shop," she said. Asked if she knew what had happened there, she removed a small ceramic pot from a nearby shelf and held it out for me to see. It was filled with incense sticks. They burn one on the memorial plaque every morning, she said, in memory of the girls. "We hope," she said, "if we remember them, when we die, someone will remember us." When I left, I walked across the parking lot to the bronze plaque. A number of blackened incense sticks lay on it. I once heard Barbara Ayers Wilson say she wished somebody would burn the ICBY shop to the ground. But when I told her about the nail salon and the incense, she relented somewhat. "Well," she said, "I guess that's about as good as it could be." Jones at the Embassy Suites. In the spring of 2014, when his old friend Howard Williams asked if he'd give a talk at the Texas Citizens Police Academy convention in San Marcos, John Jones said, "Talk about what?" Williams had been the San Marcos police chief for 11 years, but he'd begun his career in Austin, and he and Jones had worked together, William said, yogurt shop, what else? As for the specific topic, it could be anything Jones wanted to talk about. Hour and a half, July 29th. Embassy Suites Conference Center, I-35 South. 8 in the morning. Probably between 60 and 80 people in attendance. It didn't take Jones long to figure out what he had to say that hadn't already been talked to death, so he said yes. The TCPA is a statewide organization of citizens who want to learn about and support police work. To become members, they attend a course that lasts anywhere from 10 to 13 weeks and covers what an officer has to know in order to do his job. The instruction is free, and lectures include DWI procedures, the use of force, patrol tactics, the protocol and procedures used in drug enforcement, criminal investigations, and evidence collection. How to be a cop, in other words. After graduating, members are sometimes asked to participate in neighborhood watch activities and ride out with cops. Vigilantism is not encouraged, but keeping vigilant is. When the convention schedule was released, Jones's talk was announced as the feature presentation. His subject, Police Officer Stress in a High-Profile Investigation, a Case Study, the Yogurt Shop Murders of 1991. He decided to take the conventioneers behind the curtain and talk about the toll taken not just on police officers, but on their whole families. He'd initially convinced his ex-wife, Yolanda, to participate, but she pulled out 2 days before the meeting. Though their four daughters tried to persuade her to go, she refused. That time, she said, was too painful. She didn't want to relive it. Just as well. There must have been 300 people sitting 8 to a table in the ballroom, waiting for techies to set up Jones's PowerPoint presentation. Jones said he'd gone to smaller rooms first, looking for where he was supposed to speak. He'd hoped to wander through the audience while images flashed by on the screen, then found himself on stage with little room to move and all those people out there. I sat in a chair pushed against the wall, too far away from the lectern to see much, but I did notice he was wearing a bow tie and a black suit jacket with wide satiny lapels. I knew he was a spiffy dresser, but a tux and patent leather shoes at 8 in the morning? The computer guys got the software ready to go, but Jones didn't use it much. He just talked, and mostly rambled. My rambling, he said, may give you an idea of what goes on inside. Yogurt Shop, he said, had had a profound, ineradicable effect on him. When his wife sued him for divorce on grounds of non-performance as a husband, he agreed with her charges. Since the night he became case agent of the multiple murders at the ICBY shop, he had been obsessed, single-minded, snarly, socially incapacitated, and a total loser as both husband and father. He'd converted to Catholicism in 1994, and his wife was a lifelong Catholic. Even so, for the divorce he had to go to court and face the music. Cops hate to admit they're wrong, and they hate to fail. He'd done both, and was here to tell us that the reason was Yogurt Shop. The pressures of living in a glass house that was more in a political spectrum than one of law enforcement, then coming home to a family in chaos, with two daughters in their teens and two who were 3 and 4 at the time of the murders, then in the early years of elementary school as the case dragged on. He'd never believed it when people said they stayed together because of the children, but that's what he and Yolanda had done. Then 3 of the victims' parents had come to him to say he wasn't looking so good, that maybe he should go see somebody, and he thought, wait, they're the victim's parents, not me. So he'd taken their advice and been officially diagnosed as having PTSD and ADHD. He listed some of the symptoms: insomnia, inability to trust or show love, inwardness, tension. After he was taken off the case, he went into hiding. Stayed away from folks. Didn't make friends. All of the symptoms he'd shown at the time of his diagnosis still affected his life and made him who he was. And so, he said, I ramble. Most of the members of his audience weren't from Austin, and many who were didn't know the details of Yogurt Shop, so people began squirming in their seats. But Jones recaptured their attention when he told the story of his first newsworthy case, which came in 1989, when a 180-year-old live oak, said to have been the site of an important treaty signing between Texas heroes Stephen F. Austin and local Indian leaders, was poisoned and began to die, the culprit having used enough of the powerful herbicide Velpar to kill 100 trees. Jones's assignment was considered a joke by his supervisor, a kind of initiation when he moved from assault and family violence to robbery. They called the crime an arborcide. But the poisoning of the treaty oak went viral, and as the APD spokesperson, he found himself interviewed day and night. They solved the case pretty quickly after a woman called and said she thought her ex-boyfriend had done it. When they went to the guy's apartment, he immediately confessed. He was a member of the Aryan Nation, John said, so me and him, we got along real good. This, his only reference to his race, got a big laugh, and from then on the audience was with him. Calling himself a supervisory nightmare, he compared a stint in homicide with an assembly line job, but there, you measure time by the number of bodies that roll by. He had seen 150, he said, and the last four were the girls at the yogurt shop. He told about that night and the television reporter who rode out with him, and how the footage the videographer shot of him driving to the ICBY shop was later used on 48 Hours. And he described the hideous green and white shirt he had on when he got the calls, saying a fire, a homicide, three girls, no, four, as he drove north up the interstate, and about Troy Gay getting to the yogurt shop within 5 minutes of a flashover, which would have destroyed whatever evidence they could manage to collect. He explained why he'd automatically been made case agent, and quickly chose Mike, Huck, Huckabee as his partner, and told of their mutual agreement that if you didn't solve a crime in 3 days, you were going backward in a hurry. And also that because this was an unusual case, requiring unusual methods, they would not file for an arrest warrant until they had a suspect or suspects they felt sure were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, even though they didn't need to be that certain. All they needed to arrest a suspect in a criminal investigation was probable cause, and in civil cases, a preponderance of evidence. Probable cause wasn't that hard to come by, and the DA's office expected cops to supply only that level of certainty, but he and Huck decided between themselves not to go that route, and that's how they operated during their years on the case. Then he told about the Mexican nationals and the 6 written confessions, the 240 witnesses, the 203 affidavits, and the 159 apartments they'd searched, the moving violation citations they'd gone through, the people in black, the witches and Satanists. But what got him in trouble with his boss was getting too close to the families of the victims, especially after he okayed that letter they wrote to the Mexican Attorney General. As for the harsh criticism he, Huck, and the others received for their conduct at the crime scene and collecting the evidence, he defended himself and all the agencies that worked with him that night by saying, look, back then we called the DPS evidence collecting unit the fingerprint team. That's what they had in 1991. But in fact, everybody did their job. Might not have been perfect, but they did their job. When an official held up a 10-minute warning sign, Jones mentioned his attire. He'd decided to wear his tux this morning, he said, admitting that he did have a flair for the dramatic. "But I hate jackets," he said, removing his coat, folding it carefully and setting it aside. "This is me," he said, holding his arms out. "Bow tie, suspenders, white t-shirt, no sleeves." Beneath the jacket, his arms were bare. "I brought out the guns," he said later, laughing. He ended on a final note about the effect of PTSD on a human being, whether a police officer or a soldier. "Damage," he said. "Damage, damage, damage." And when someone asked if he thought those four guys were guilty, he said, "I don't know. I just don't know." It wasn't a great talk, but it pretty much summed up the effect of Yogurt Shop on every single person involved in the case in any way. Nobody escaped unscathed. Not cops, firefighters, FBI and BATF agents, lawyers, the judge, the families and friends of the girls, other ICBY employees, customers. Carlos Garcia agrees. "Of course he has PTSD," he says. "Everybody who was at the crime scene has it. Him probably the worst." As I made my way out of the hotel, a conferee sidelined me and asked why I was leaving. Wasn't I going to the body farm? I'd read about the impending TCPA trip to Texas State University's Forensic Anthropology Research Facility, where donor bodies are allowed to decompose in various conditions of climate and topography. I said I had to get home. "Oh," she said, "she wouldn't miss it for anything." 2015. Austin's population is up to around 1 million today, give or take, about twice the size it was in 1991. We have high-rises downtown, gridlock during rush hour, and a light rail system. Statistics say 65 people move here every day, a figure that keeps going up, along with the real estate values. A beautiful white stone boardwalk is connected to the Lady Bird Johnson hike and bike trail, allowing us to walk the full 10 miles around the lake, bearing that great lady's name. In a city of festivals, we can choose from South by Southwest's film and interactive festivals, followed by its music festival, the Fusebox Festival, the Austin City Limits Festival, the Texas Book Festival, the Republic of Texas Motorcycle Rally, the Reggae Festival, the Art Outside Festival, the Fun 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 and Frontera Fests, and the newest, the Formula One Grand Prix, which is attended mostly by Europeans and South Americans. There are triathlons, marathons, dog parades. Eeyore's birthday party doesn't attract the crowds it used to, but it's still on the calendar. In my neighborhood, an outdoor venue called Festival Beach hosts weekend celebrations without an actual beach, whose themes include Celtic and Pachanga music, raw food, and when summertime temperatures reach into the three digits, a hot sauce festival. Some of us wonder how long the city can support the weight of all those visitors and new citizens, and we're swallowing up towns in every direction. I didn't grow up here, go to UT, or live here during the glory days of the Armadillo World Headquarters and Janis Joplin. But a friend who did, and now lives in Baltimore, said, "I'd move back to Austin, but I don't like what's happening here." And I had to wonder, compared to what, Baltimore? And when I asked another friend who lived here then if he felt nostalgic, he said, "Why wouldn't I? It was fabulous." Some things remain the same. Except for the debilitating heat in July and August, outdoor life couldn't be better, swimming especially. Houstonians still sniff at what they consider our local self-obsession and the absence of world-class cultural institutions, but here we are, still emerging. We aren't big enough to have a professional sports team, so many of those who yearn for that either travel to San Antonio or root for the Longhorns. Casual dress is an art form and we're competing with Portland, Oregon to be the most tattooed and pierced, dog-friendly, and proudly weird city in the country. 2016. Maria Thomas died abruptly, if not unexpectedly, last spring, but the family managed to keep the manner of her passing under wraps, and I didn't find out about it for months. Barbara Ayers Wilson was with Maria in her last days and helped her daughter Sonora make funeral arrangements. The Statesman's obituary was brief, and few people involved in Yogurt Shop seemed to have read it. But two members of the DA's staff did attend the funeral, and one of them approached Barbara afterward to say he hoped they'd done right by the girls and their families. Barbara and her husband, Manly, run an on-call legal protection business out of their home in Kyle, one of those small towns being quickly swallowed up by Greater Austin. She also spends a lot of time with two step-grandbabies, twin girls, who, because one is chubby and one tiny, remind her of Sarah and Jennifer. Bob and Pam Ayers live and work west of Austin. They mostly keep to themselves, although if anything broke in the case, Bob would surely be the first parent to show up. Sydney Lanier High School has installed sturdy pens, troughs, and other amenities for the use of FFA members. The Ag Farm, visited by Jennifer, Sarah, and Eliza on the morning of December 6, 1991, is now an open, weedy field. Divorced in 2015, Michael and Janine Scott live far apart. Mike in Florida, where he works for a structural steel company. Janine in Iowa with Jasmine. Their parting, according to Janine, was not friendly. All Mike will say about that stuff back there is he had nothing to do with it, and if anybody wants to know anything else or ask him to participate in the innocence thing, they should talk to his lawyer, Tony Diaz. Broadus Spivey and his three colleagues, Jim Hackney, Amber Farrelly, and the retired judge, Charlie Baird, await word from the Third Court of Appeals regarding their April oral argument, asking that Robert Springsteen be given the day in court they maintain he deserves. Because the law doesn't specifically cover Rob's situation, they are arguing for a novel approach in which their client would present his case, including the DNA evidence that disproves his confession about raping Amy Ayers, before a civil judge, who would then rule on the validity of his appeal. Two staff members from Rose Lemberg's office argued fiercely against Spivey's position, accusing his team of making an end run around the law. In response, Spivey said prosecutors are stonewalling because they don't want to admit they screwed up. He also believes Springsteen's appeal could open an avenue for others struggling to establish their innocence. All these people need, he told a television reporter, is some forum in which to test whether they are innocent or not. Otherwise, they're in limbo. If granted, Springsteen would become eligible for more than $700,000, in addition to the other benefits. If not, Spivey plans to present his argument before the Texas Supreme Court. Remarried, Springsteen still lives in West Virginia. On the Sunday before his case came before the Third Court, the Statesman ran the story on the front page. Headlined, Suspect in Yogurt Shop Killings, Clear My Name. The report rehashed the entire saga and featured a number of photographs, including the ones taken of the four suspects after their 1999 arrests, and another of a man on a ladder putting up the original Who Killed These Girls billboard. Most online comments to the story lambasted Springsteen for daring to make his appeal since he was obviously guilty. A few weeks later, Broadus Spivey received a handwritten letter from a woman in Walla Walla, Washington, naming the Yogurt Shop killers and warning him to watch his back because the two men were contract killers who also liked to commit, quote, recreational murder. Soon after that, John Jones received a call from a relative of Amy Ayers saying she wanted to fight Springsteen's suit. And so the controversy and the intransigent position taking rock on and on. On his current Facebook page, Forrest Wellborn lists Austin as his home and Patriot Fence Company as his employer. He has bulked up significantly in the 6 years since his 48 Hours interview with Aaron Moriarty, and has shaved his head and grown a thick goatee. His profile photo shows him looking straight into the camera lens, frowning, his eyes in an angry squint. When one of his friends asks why he looks so mad when he's alive and should be happy, Forrest replies, "That's me smiling." In June, Forrest agreed to talk with me about his current life and the effects of Yogurt Shop, but didn't show up for the meeting. His lawyer, Robert Eisenhower Ramirez, wasn't surprised. He said it was really hard to get Forrest to talk about this case, and besides, he thought they'd proved out his client's innocence during the cert hearings, so no wonder. Though retired, Gene Muirer and Mike Lynch maintain a connection with the Travis County court system as visiting judges. In 2014, Lynch wrote the blueprint for an overhaul of the county indigent criminal defense system, resulting in the creation of the Capital Area Private Defender Service, a carefully structured organization whose job is to select and appoint counsel for criminal defendants who can't afford to pay for an attorney. This is something he's thought about for a long time, feeling that, in his experience, defendants often became convinced that judges selected lawyers who'd get the work done quickly by agreeing to a plea deal, thereby moving the docket along. He's proud of having made this happen. "It isn't easy to convince judges to give up anything," he says now, "but eventually most of them went along. They still get to appoint counsel in capital cases." Lynch also works in the public school system, helping teenage kids learn about the law. So he's busy. After her arrest on a shocking DWI charge, the videotape of which quickly reached the internet, as part of her plea agreement, Rosemary Lemberg agreed to step down in November when she will be replaced. John Jones applied for a job as Cap Metro's head of security, but the job went to an applicant from Arizona. Jones murmured in mock contemplation. "Isn't Arizona the state that refused to honor Martin Luther King Day?" Carlos Garcia, who's returned to private practice, says every time he looks at his ICBY hard files, he thinks about burning them, just to get them out of his life. "But," he says and shrugs, "I've digitized them all so I'd still have them." He's back on the short list of capital case certified attorneys and is working on two, in one of which the DA is asking for death. Tony Diaz speaks often to Michael Scott and regrets not pursuing a civil case against the state. He fights back tears when recalling how Mike looked during his incarceration in county jail, handcuffed and hopeful, and says Janine Scott is his hero for refusing ever to back down from her belief in her husband's innocence. Sawyer's still on the short list as well, but he's less inclined to take on a capital case these days, partly because they take so much time, and also because they're just so personally intense and difficult. He's become friendly enough with Efren de la Fuente to ask about Yogurt Shop. "Oh," he says, De La Fuente replied, "that's all over." In addition, Amber Farrelly swears that, walking into the courthouse one afternoon, she passed two guys struggling with a flat roller cart stacked with banker's boxes marked YSM, with the Scott and Springsteen case numbers. "The famous 33 boxes," she says. She wasn't in the courthouse long, but when she came out, the guys were still wrestling with the boxes and loading them into a van. She called Alexandra Gauthier, now a magistrate judge in Williamson County, who said the boxes were probably heading for storage. Two defense lawyers, friends of Ronnie Earle, say the retired DA has told them in confidence that he doesn't think the four guys they arrested for yogurt shop were the real killers. That being the case, we have to wonder, why doesn't he say so publicly? Broadus Spivey has assured the courts that his plan does not preclude Springsteen's future arrest, but we also have to wonder if the state is really planning ever to charge him and Michael Scott again. Or will the 33 boxes gather dust in some dark basement from now on? As of mid-2016, we have no answers to those questions, and we still don't know who killed those girls. Over lunch one day, I asked John Jones if he thought we ever would. Like most cops, he's a confirmed skeptic, so his answer surprised me. "Oh, yeah," he said with a little shrug. "We'll know. Someday." Epilogue. There are several ways to look at it. It was Maurice Pierce, after all, who set the ball rolling when he showed up at North Cross Mall with a loaded .22 pistol in his waistband and 16 rounds of ammunition in his jeans pocket, then told Hector Polanco that his friend, Forrest Wellborn, had borrowed the gun and might have used it to kill the yogurt girls. And when the cop asked Maurice what he'd been up to on the night of the murders, he said hanging out with his friends Forrest, Rob Springsteen, and Mike Scott. So there they were, the four guys. If Maurice hadn't pulled that prank, who knows? Paul Johnson might have found somebody else in the tips file to pursue, and this whole story might have gone off in a completely different direction. But Maurice was Maurice, and that's pretty much all there is to say about what he did and why he did it. On Friday, December 23, 2010, he was living part-time in Austin with his sister, Renee Reyna, and part-time in Louisville with his wife, Kimberly, and daughter, Marissa, who'd graduated from high school the previous June and was almost 9 months pregnant with his first grandchild. In the spring, he'd face a felony charge for assaulting the Plano police officer. One reason he was commuting was that people in Collin County now knew who he was, which made jobs even harder to come by than before. Also, he and Kimberly were having problems. So when one of her relatives offered him work in his Austin landscaping business, Maurice moved in with Renee. They'd closed early that day because of the Christmas holiday, and then he'd gone out to have some drinks with friends. He was heading back to his sister's, the same house where the task force tasered him in 2007, to spend the night before driving home the next morning to spend Christmas with his daughter. Marissa said she and her father spoke on their cell phones every night, and that night was no different from any other. Maurice was talking away when, at about 10:54, he exited Highway 183 and turned into Renee's neighborhood on Palmer Lane. Most of the medium-sized ranch-style houses had several big cars or pickup trucks parked in their driveways. When Maurice got to the stop sign at Shreveport and Carrera, the streets were empty, and so, slightly zonked, talking to Marissa, he slid right through. Who could have predicted that two cops would be staked out in the next block watching for speeders? Who would have believed this coincidence, if that's what it was? In fact, we might wonder why cops were patrolling a dark, quiet neighborhood in northwest Austin that late, only two nights before Christmas. When the story broke the next day, newspaper and television reporters would refer to the neighborhood as Metric. A couple of people I know told me that drug dealers had moved to Metric because it was safe and out of the way. Maybe that was why a seasoned five-year veteran, Frank Wilson, had chosen that particular neighborhood as a training ground for his partner, Bradley Smith. According to the incident report, when a black SUV ran that stop sign, the cops turned on their flashers. Later, Renee's husband will say he actually saw the whirling lights from their living room window. Because Maurice was due back at any minute and was always getting in trouble, He wondered if it was happening again. When investigators listened to Marissa Pierce's cell phone conversation with her father, they reportedly heard Maurice say he was almost home, and then noted a change in his voice. "They're after me again," he told his daughter. And then, Marissa said later, "he told me he loved me and that he would never see me again." Maurice kept going for a couple of blocks before pulling over. Wilson and Smith pulled up behind him. The press will refer to this as a routine traffic stop. But as John Jones often says, no police work is routine unless you're sitting at a desk doing paperwork. Once you're on the street, anything can happen. Maurice got out of his car. Police don't like it when drivers do that, and he certainly had enough experience with cops to know that. But he thought he was in big trouble again, and had already told Marissa she'd never see him again. So he did what he felt like. He exited his vehicle, as the police would say. Wilson approached on foot, with one hand on his holster, as protocol required. There have been a number of shootings in Austin when a police officer has shot an unarmed man, claiming the victim had moved in a threatening manner or was holding something that looked like a gun. Usually after an internal investigation, the cop is cleared. The chief finds a justification for the shooting. The family of the dead man raises a ruckus. Life moves on. But to be on the safe side, Art Acevedo had ordered dashboard cameras installed in all police cruisers so that even minor traffic stops could be recorded. The dash camera in Wilson's car was running. At this point, Marissa says she began wildly texting her father, who didn't respond. She texted Raina, who in turn texted Maurice and got no answer. "I think they're after him," her husband said. Pierce didn't answer these texts for a simple reason, because instead of standing by his car waiting, he did what he always did when he was in trouble. He ran. Frank Wilson pursued on foot, Smith following close behind in the cruiser. When asked, Ron Lotter will admit that the cold case unit had certainly kept up with Maurice. They knew where he lived, what jobs he'd held, what kind of car he drove, and, of course, all about his troubles in Collin County. Maybe they were still hoping to make a yogurt shop deal with him before he went on trial for the assault. But Lara and other officers insisted they weren't actively tracking him. As for Frank Wilson, he hadn't lived in Austin at the time of the murders, the arrests, or the trials, so the name Maurice Pierce meant nothing to him. He was simply pursuing someone who'd aroused his suspicion by running from a straightforward traffic stop. Everybody I've talked to, or who was quoted in the press, thinks Wilson was telling the truth. It all happened so fast, and the night was dark. Even people who don't believe in coincidences think maybe this might be the exception. In no time, Wilson caught up with the runner, and they tussled. Wilson wore a utility knife on his duty belt for backup, and Pierce grabbed for it. Aside from the policeman's testimony and the dash cam video, you can't really tell what happened. There were no witnesses, and while the dash camera captured the struggle, details are fuzzy. What is clear is that at some point, Maurice snatched Wilson's knife from his belt and slashed the right side of his neck, nicking his carotid artery. Pierce then ran off, but before falling to the ground, the officer grabbed his revolver and fired one round. Maurice Pierce made it through a few front yards before collapsing in a driveway, only a block or so from his sister's home. Renee Reyna says she heard the pop. Smith called for assistance and applied pressure to Wilson's neck to staunch the blood flow. An ambulance arrived within minutes. Transporters from the ME's office soon zipped Maurice in a body bag and drove him to the morgue. On the Christmas Eve news, a man who lived nearby told a reporter that he'd heard a gunshot and had gone to his front door and looked out in time to see a man fall into a driveway and not get up. When the station's video camera panned the neighborhood, You could see Christmas lights in the windows of every house. 5 hours after the shooting, a detective came to Carrera Lane to tell Reyna that a police officer had shot a man they were almost certain was her brother. After a night in intensive care, Frank Wilson was released. He went home to spend the holidays with his family. Victim services sent emails to the families of the four girls that evening to inform them of the shooting before they read about it in the paper or heard it on TV. One girl's father texted his ex-wife to say, "Ding dong, the witch is dead." On Christmas Day, the Statesman's lead story was headlined, "Yogurt Shop Suspect Dies in Shooting." There were photos of Pierce, Wilson, and Smith, and a map of the area where the traffic stop and shooting had occurred. 5 months later, on May 22, 2011, the Statesman ran another front-page story headlined, "Who Was Maurice Pierce?" which was accompanied by the photo taken the day he was released from jail in 2003, when, in his loose white T-shirt and blue jeans, he sprinted away from reporters. That was the day before he wished the press and the city of Austin Godspeed. The paper then told Maurice's story, mostly from his family's perspective. Ever since the yogurt shop arrest, they said, his life was about the murders and nothing else. He couldn't get work or sign a lease without somebody saying, "Aren't you the one?" He was afraid of the police and saw them coming after him everywhere, even when the family took trips out of the state. Marissa said she tried to convince her father to live within the limits of the law, and that if he was ever pulled over, he should simply take the ticket and move on. But that's something he would never do. On September 22, 2011, after a Travis County grand jury declined to indict Frank Wilson, investigative details were revealed that, as the Statesman put it, shed new light on Pierce's mindset the night he died. Apparently, after having dinner with a nephew, he'd gone to the apartment of a woman who provided police with a written statement saying that she and Maurice had been in an intimate and tumultuous relationship, off and on for 6 months, but she'd pretty much ended it because of his fierce fits of jealousy, which once had led him to strike her in the face. On December 23rd, he'd arrived, uninvited, at her house around 6:30, and had begun drinking and getting very jealous. When he got out of line, she'd poured a can of beer over his head. He'd left at about 10. Among the papers sent to the grand jury by the DA's office was a toxicology report showing that when Pierce was shot, he had a blood alcohol level of 0.14, well above the 0.08 legal driving limit. It's possible to take an ironic narrative slant on the life of Maurice Pierce as the story of a risk-taking boy who would not live to see his first grandchild or ever get out from under the sway of his demons, who could never manage to follow his daughter's advice and just take the ticket. People convinced he was the yogurt shop ringleader might well have imagined that a vengeful God had finally delivered justice. Others might wonder if, had he lived, he could have cleaned up his act and moved on. My guess is, Maurice knew all along what lay ahead for him. Behind the high wire shine in his eyes was pure sadness, obvious in every photograph as he sits there looking beyond the camera lens into what seemed to be his inevitable future, eyebrows pressed down at the outer edges like a soulful clown's. Maybe it's only because I know what was going to happen that I see something in that gaze that says, "This will never end well, not for me." Appendices. Appendix 1. Michael Scott Written Statement. After giving his phone number, address, and social security information and confirming that he has been read his rights, he continues, "My name is Michael James Scott. I was born on 2/6 of 74. I'm currently at the Austin Police Department Homicide Office at the Twin Towers giving this statement to Detective Manuel Fuentes and Texas Ranger Sal Abreu. I am giving this statement about my involvement in the death of the four girls at the yogurt shop on December 6, 1991. I have previously given accounts of what happened in 1991 and afterwards to Detective Fuentes, Texas Ranger Sal Abreu, Detective Merrill, Detective Ron Lara, and other detectives. Today I told Detective Fuentes and Texas Ranger Sal Abreu that now that I have confessed to my father and my best friend Patrick Davidson in my part in the girl's death, I have been able to remember and I want this statement to be correct and truthful. These things I will clear up in this statement, such as what I threw off the bridge after the murders. I had previously said that I threw a set of keys off the bridge. It was actually a cutting knife that I got from inside the yogurt shop. When I told you that I didn't really remember what happened to the second gun, that small semi-automatic pistol, I do remember that I gave it to my friend Patrick Davidson in December of 1992 so that he could get rid of it. I did not want to pull him into this, and that is why I had been so hesitant to tell you what happened to the gun. If something happens to him, he has nothing to fall back on. I will explain this more in detail later. On December 6, 1991, I was with my friends Maurice, Rob Springsteen, and Forrest. I wasn't sure about Maurice and Forrest's last name. I had been living with Robert Springsteen at his father's condominium on Dry Creek Drive. I think the apartment was right across from the swimming pool. We were at the North Cross Mall, sitting at a round table at the food court. Maurice brought up that he needed to get some money. I don't remember the specifics about what was discussed, but I do know that this is what brought all this to be. Maurice and Rob talked about robbing a place. They said this would be the easiest way to get some money. I got up and walked around the mall. I remember being in the arcade, and then I remember coming back to the table and sitting down. Maurice got up and walked around with somebody. I don't know who it was. I had seen him before, but didn't know who he was. Ranger Abreu asked me what time was this happening. I don't remember exactly what time it was, but it was still daylight. We were all at the table when Maurice said we needed to go and look around. I believed him to mean he wanted to find a place to rob. When we left, Maurice was driving his dad's gray Ford LTD. Rob was sitting in the right front seat. I sat back behind the driver. Forrest was in the back seat with me. We drove around and looked at the businesses around the North Cross area. We drove up to the strip mall where the I Can't Believe It's yogurt shop was at. We looked at the businesses that were at the mall. Maurice was the one that said something like, "Let's go inside and take a look at the yogurt shop." Maurice went in and bought a yogurt swirl, chocolate and vanilla. I followed Rob inside. I sat down and Rob came over and said something to me, and we got up and made it look like we were going to the restroom. Maurice was up at the counter talking to at least one of the girls. I remember that he was talking to the dark-haired girl. Maurice was supposed to distract them. Rob and I walked out the back and walked around to the front of the building. When we got around to the front, Maurice was already in the car eating his yogurt. We drove back to the mall and we sat at the same table. It was the same table we always sat at. Detective Fuentes asked me if we were armed at the time we cased the store. No, the guns were left inside the car at the time. We sat at the table and, BSing with Forrest, we were just talking, not about what was fixing to happen. I remember eating some curly fries, and it was strange that I remember a large Mexican boy that we all knew in passing who had come sit down with us. The Mexican boy picked up the container of ketchup and started drinking it. I walked around the mall with Rob. We ran into Maurice again when we were walking around. Maurice told us that it was time to go. We got back into his car. Maurice was driving. I was in the back seat, and Rob and Forrest were in the car with us. We drove around the neighborhood more. I think we were looking for a route to take, and there was talk about how often the cops drove around, and if there was a general route they drove around in. I know it was dark when we left North Cross Mall. Most of the businesses were closed when we got over to the yogurt shop. We drove across the parking lot and drove through the alley behind the stores. We wanted to see if there was any vehicles parked in the back, or if there were any people back there. I believe we even wanted to see if the back double doors were still slightly open. We drove back through the parking lot and then back to the rear of the store. I remember the building was on the driver's side, the left side of the car. We stopped just past the double doors, not more than 50 feet past the doors. Maurice told Forrest that the only thing that he had to do was honk the horn if anyone was coming. Maurice pulled out his gun. I believe that he had it in between the seat. I know Rob had a gun because he looked at it before we went inside to make sure it was loaded. Before we went in, Maurice told me to make sure that I brought a can of Zippo lighter fluid. It was the bigger metal can. Texas Ranger Sal Abreu asked me why I thought we brought the can of lighter fluid. I believe Maurice wanted to use it to cover our tracks. We went into the back door. Maurice went in first, then Rob, and then I followed them. One of the girls said something like, "Hey, you, what are you doing? You don't belong in here." This girl was wearing a T-shirt, I believe, that had the name "I Can't Believe It's Yogurt" on it. I believe that she was working in the back room when we entered the back. Rob told me to stop and stay right there and not let anyone out the back. We were all surprised because we expected to find only two girls inside the store, and there were two other girls up at the front in the dining room area sitting down. I could see the commotion going on up front. I remember Maurice told me to check the front door to make sure it was locked. He also told me to check to see if there was anyone out front that could see us. I checked the door, and it was locked. There was one key in the lock. The door was locked. I looked outside to make sure no one was looking in. As this went along, I got more and more scared. I heard the cash register open. I heard the drawer being lifted and slammed back. I saw Maurice at the cash register, and I saw him put something in his pocket. I thought to myself that he had just put money in his pocket. All the girls were in the back with Rob. I looked out to check the front again. I heard Maurice say something like, "Where in the fuck is the rest of the money?" I heard the girls crying, and one of the girls said, "That's all there is. It's already been dropped, and you can't get to it." I heard Rob say, "Come help me with this." I went back there, and he wanted help tying them up. When I went back there, I saw that all four girls were naked. I believe this is the way that it was because I don't remember pulling their clothes off. I went to the pile of clothes and picked up some clothes to use to tie them up. I remember a T-shirt and a bra that we used to tie them up. The girls were crying and whimpering. They were begging for us not to kill them. They said they didn't want to die. I got a paper towel and put it inside one of the girls' mouth. I remember that my finger pushed through the towel when I was trying to stuff it in her mouth. This may not have worked, so I may have had to use something else to stuff in her mouth. It was white like terry cloth. The girls were on their knees. I don't believe they were standing up because I was looking down at them. Rob told me to check the front. I went up front and remember what sounded like one of the girls trying to scream. Maurice was screaming, saying, "Where the fuck is the rest of the money?" I heard a bang, a crack. It sounded like a gun going off. I checked the lock one last time, and I turned around to see what happened. One of the girls was already dead. I think Maurice shot that one. After the shot, Maurice said again, Where in the fuck is the rest of the money? And there was a second shot. I went to the back and saw Rob, and he had one of the dark-haired girls on her hands and knees, and he's raping her hard. I told Rob that this wasn't right. That's not what he came here for. Rob stood up, and I don't know if he finished. I did not see his dick. I know that Maurice was not back there with Rob. Maurice had gone into an office, and he had one of the girls with him. He was squatting down, and I think she was trying to open a safe or something. Rob told me to do one of the girls. I believe it was the one that he had just did. He told me not to be a pussy and told me if I didn't, then I was next. We laid the girl on the floor and I got on top of her. I tried to do her from the front. I looked at her. I didn't want to look at her face. She had a piece of white terry cloth towel on her mouth. I looked away because I didn't want to see her. I couldn't get it up because I knew what I was doing was wrong. I sort of faked it to make Rob think I did her. I got up and remember either Maurice or Rob telling me to finish her. I remember grabbing the revolver from Maurice. He told me to finish her. The girl was still on the floor, and I pointed the gun at her and tried to shoot it first, but couldn't. Maurice told me to do it or I would be next. I pointed the gun again at the girl and fired once into her head. I remember Rob pushed me toward Maurice. Maurice was in the other room with the other girl. I don't remember seeing a safe, but I don't remember what she was doing down on the floor. I remember looking in the doorway and the gun was still in my hand. Maurice asked Rob if I did it and Rob said, yeah, he finished her. Maurice told me, you are in this neck deep already. I saw the side profile of this girl. She had like a white shirt on. I think she had dark hair. Rob was standing right there, and he had the small semi-automatic gun. Rob told me not to be a puss. I think I shot her in the head. I've been not wanting to remember this. I know I have told you had something different, but I did her too because Maurice and Rob were pressuring me. I dropped the revolver. Maurice was mad at me. He asked me where the lighter fluid was, and I had thought I had left it in the car. He told me to go out to the car and get it. I looked at Forrest, and then I looked at the floorboard and picked up the lighter fluid. Forrest did not say a word. I went back inside. Rob told me to burn the place. I saw the girls laying there, and I pulled one of the girls on top of the other. Rob was watching me as I gathered up napkins, cups, and paper towels and piled them on top of the three girls. I sprayed Zippo fluid on top of the girls. I emptied the can of lighter fluid. I had a Zippo lighter with me and I lit the fire. I heard a whoosh sound of the accelerant when it caught fire. I don't remember what I did with the can. I could have threw it on the pile of stuff in the back of the store. I remembered that my only thought was to get out. I went outside and remembered that Forrest was not in the car anymore. I had taken a knife from inside the shop. I believe I got it off the counter. It was a nice knife. I told you all before that I had taken a set of keys, but it was a knife. I remember now that it was a knife. Rob and I were already back in the car when Maurice got there. I asked Maurice where Forrest was. He said that he must have took off. Texas Ranger Sal Abreu asked me how long were we in the shop. I think we were in there about 20 to 25 minutes. I'm not sure. We were in the car, and on the way out we saw Forrest. He was in the parking lot somewhere, and we picked him up. I remember driving, but I don't remember what direction we went. We stopped at some bridge. It was about 10 to 15 minutes away from the shop. I got out and threw up over the railing of the bridge. I took the knife and threw it over the rail also. I made sure it was gone. I remember trees, and I don't remember seeing any water. I got back into the car. I don't know what happened next. I remember being back at the apartment. Detective Fuentes asked me to describe the two guns. The gun that Maurice had was a black 22 caliber revolver, small. I think it had wood grips. The gun that Rob had was a small semi-automatic pistol. It had a clip. I think it was a 38. Some of the right